we will do this morning is because all of our House members have to leave at approximately 9 o'clock, and because I do have a few members on this committee that, let's say, I'm expecting this to be an interesting discussion on water issues, and so I would like to make sure that the House members had as much opportunity to participate as possible. So what we'll do is just go for 25 minutes or so, then we will come back to the budget next Monday, and presuming that we do not have conflicts in the next week in terms of our sessions here, I'm optimistic that we will not. So with that, Mr. Siebert, I think, may have a few comments to begin with.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you find that your place not only agenda for today and a copy of the department's budget bill, you also find a copy of the weekly agenda that has 2 weeks, next week and the following week on it, on the back. And also just a little bit of housekeeping. You should have at your places a couple pages, the first of which looks like this, that need to be inserted into your budget summary book. The first one, Chapter 3, Agency Performance Measures, is under Tab 3. And the second one, Key Performance Measures from the Report, is under Tab 8. And you can see the page numbers if you want to just insert those. And that's it, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Mr. Ward? Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr.
I guess
Chair.
We'll go through somewhat of a brief overview and then into budget drivers, and we may not get any farther than that today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department. With me is Debbie Colbert from my office and Lisa Pearson from DAS-BAM. And we're happy to be here this morning, get to talk a little bit about our budget with you all. I would note that at your place, and as Senator Avakian noted earlier, is a handy little conversion card that we thought you all might want to keep in your wallets.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I need to know what the definition of miner's inches is. And just to give you a heads up, when you're done with that, we're going straight into whatever the other one was I said I didn't understand. Does anybody know?
Head.
Thank you. Yeah, the one that had something to do with a head. I can't even find it. Waterhead.
So, Mr. Chair, with your permission, we're going to bring the Deputy Director up here, who has been with the agency since the Water Code was adopted in 1909, to answer these questions for the Senate.
I thought you were going to say since the first water right.
And I know we have 25 minutes, so try and get it within that time period if you can.
So you got miner's inches.
Miner's inches.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom Fall, Deputy Director, Oregon Water Resources Department. A lot of the original water use that occurred in the state of Oregon was for mining purposes. And a miner's inch is the volume of water that will go through a one-inch square. At a certain head, it is about 11.62 gallons per minute. Or 11.25 gallons per minute. It's right around that quantity of water. It is the amount of water in many places in Oregon. We have a rate for irrigation, and you'll see in eastern Oregon it's common to have a rate of 1/40th of a cubic foot per second per acre. So for 40 acres, it's 1 cubic foot per second. You'll notice 40 miner's inches is 1 cubic foot per second.
Everybody understand that?
Oh, yeah.
I still don't get the miner's inches. Whether there's a reference in inches is what, respect to miner?
It's the volume of water that will go through the one-inch square.
Okay, so it's good, it refers to the one. We have on the state seal, we have a pickaxe referring to the mining industry in Oregon, which was huge around the time of statehood, wasn't it? So that's where some of these terms come from.
That's where this one comes from, around that time, and again, it had to do with the division of water for mining purposes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging.
Did you get your answer to the waterhead?
I think you slipped in the waterhead part, didn't you?
Define waterhead for us.
Oh, thank you, Representative Burley. A very important piece that you...
Fifth grade stuff, Senator.
I think he doesn't know the... I think he doesn't know the answer and was trying to slip out without us catching
him. If I may, I think it's the pressure to raise water 1 foot.
It is 2.3 feet of water will produce 1 pound of pressure.
I guess you're
thank
wrong.
You. Thank you very much. We'll get on with the presentation. There'll be an exam on Wednesday.
Okay. So, to the staff, we may want to rethink this next year.
Okay. I think he's saving your bacon. That's worth about $500,000
from the co-chairs, just that little bit right there.
No water game shows for us.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, with your permission, we will proceed. And this is what we've attempted to do is to build a presentation that corresponds directly to the briefing document we've put together for you. So each of these chapters that you see here relate to chapters in the document. Hopefully you can follow along in that regard. We're not going to spend much time on the agency overview because we did that in January. So, Debbie, why don't you go on? And unless you have any questions on any of the material in that portion of the book, we'll keep moving. So we're to budget, drivers, and issues. And you can see the clever graphic here, our graph put together to drive home the fact that our budget has been ratcheted down in recent years and under somewhat of a squeeze. But, Representative Gerard, forgive me for starting with your neighborhood right out of the box. But one of the key budget drivers for this agency for many years has been the Klamath Basin adjudication, and indeed, the governor's recommended budget that you all are considering at this time sets aside a little over $1 million for the continuation of that modest project in the next biennium. Now, you'll note in the first bullet that we initiated the Klamath Basin adjudication. And let me back up and just say quickly, as a brief reminder, that an adjudication is something that we have to do to ascertain the priority and scope of water rights that have been claimed before the Water Code came into existence, or before Tom Paul was with the agency. And so before 1909, people were using water in this state. And we've created this adjudication process whereby we look back to ascertain the priority of those claims and the amount of those claims. And we've adjudicated about two-thirds of the surface water in the state generally. The Klamath Basin adjudication, as you can see, we've been working on since 1975. And, Mr. Chair, if I were you all, I'd be thinking, why have these folks not completed a project they started in 1975? And there's a real short answer for that.
Sound like a transportation project. Please go on.
Oh, gosh. I'm not sure that was good. There's a short answer for that, and no pun intended, Mr. Chair, but there was a stream of litigation related to the Klamath adjudication. And that litigation, Representative Gerard may know, really focused around whether the federal claimants of water could be subjected to a state adjudication. So the federal government and the tribes in the Klamath Basin both asserted that they were not subject to a state adjudication, and that litigation through two really significant court cases traveled, I think, all the way to the Supreme Court in at least one case, and ultimately the state of Oregon prevailed, and both the federal government and the tribes are a part of this process. Took many years to resolve that. Began our actual hearings on the claims and the contests to those claims in 2001. So if Paul has a claim in Klamath County for water use, I, as his neighbor, may have contested that claim when he filed it because I felt like it wasn't accurate or it might injure me. So 80% of the 87% of the actual claims have been resolved. 95% of the contests to those claims have been resolved. And then we believe a very attainable goal is to have all our basic work done, all the orders issued from the department at the end of 2009. And what we have to do is package those orders up in one document, provide them to the circuit court in Klamath County, and they make a final determination. When that's done, hopefully we'll have completed this chapter of Oregon history. So that was the first budget driver. But I...
Here, may I ask a quick question?
Yes.
So in your in the book here, it says that you expect to have the remaining proposed orders by the end of 2009. The department will then issue the final order of determination and refer the case to the Klamath County Circuit Court. Would you tell me why does it go to the court? What are they going to rule upon?
What the statute charges us to do, Mr. Chair and Representative, what the statute charges us to do is to do all the initial work, to rule from the department's adjudicator standpoint on all these claims and contests, so to issue orders on all those individual claims and contests, and then to package that up in what we call a final order of determination. So we take everything we've ruled on, put it in one document, and then the statute says that that has to be delivered to the circuit court in Klamath County for them to make the actual final decision. And so what that does is it puts the whole adjudication into the judicial arena at that point, whereas with us it's been in what we call the administrative phase. Ultimately, the final codification of that package is a judicial matter and can be contested in the court system. But a key thing to note there, if I may, Representative, is that once we've delivered our final order of determination to the Klamath Circuit Court, we can function as if that were the final deal. In other words, we can distribute water according to those priority dates, do all that work as if it were a done deal until it's changed by the circuit court.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes.
Mayor? Thank you. And so, of course, once it's in the circuit court's hands, then that decision is appealable, et cetera, all the way to the Supreme Court. Does that? But at that point, does that take that more or less out of your department as a budget driver?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would not say it will take it fully out of the department as a budget driver. It may be that it would probably be that the department would be involved defending its decisions all the way through. So certainly the budget implications for the Klamath would be less, definitely less, but there will definitely be legal costs to the agency as we work through that process. The other thing I just would note again, and we've talked about this internally recently, when we complete the Klamath adjudication, there's still a third of the rest of the state that needs to be adjudicated. And while I don't think I would recommend to you all in the future that we ever do quite as big an adjudication at one time as we have in the Klamath Basin, we will need to step through the rest of those parts of the state and finish that up.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So to budget driver number two, and this is a key budget driver for us, satisfying new demands in a system that is largely appropriated. And even though we all think, except, again, perhaps those of you not here on the west side, I think classically Oregon has thought of itself as a wet state. Yet there is an increasing need for water in this state, and we have increasing conflict over water use. Population growth, economic development, the restoration of our watersheds, these are all key drivers in terms of us needing to find additional water here in Oregon. Generally speaking, there's a decreasing supply available for all these activities. So this is I wanted to give you a look at this table because this would be a good indicator for you if you came to us and said, "I want a new water right
in Central Oregon to irrigate my land. Never irrigated land before, so it doesn't have a water right. And I want that water to be available to me in August to put on my alfalfa. Now, what that map there tells you is we're going to have a hard time getting you one because there's no available stream flow in August in Central Oregon that's not already spoken for. You can see the Willamette system highlighted as an area where there is water available today to use. However, that's largely because of the reservoir system in the Willamette system. And so the Willamette is driven today by the fact that there are 14 storage structures on that system. And so it's really a man-made system that has kept water available for us even in the summer months.
Yes.
Does that include the Columbia too? I mean, where is the Columbia in all this? Is that treated differently because it's interstate, or how's that?
Well, the Columbia, because of the flow targets for fish currently in place, we would not consider as having water available today during those flow target months, which are April 15th through the end of September.
Yes. The state of Washington has different months, don't they? Don't they? They only restrict withdrawals in July and August.
This is a policy issue that
Mr. Chair, Senator, the state of Washington has generally followed the flow targets that we have adhered to here in Oregon, April 15th through September, end of September. However, they recently did some research, and that research came back indicating that the most critical months were July and August. Is that right, Debbie?
That's right.
And so they have not issued any water rights to date under that kind of scenario. We're not certain whether they will or not, or whether they would stand up in court if they were issued.
I think it's fine. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wanted to note to you that, note as well with you all, that not only is surface water under some constraints here in the state of Oregon, but groundwater is also becoming challenged. And in Senator Nelson's neighborhood, you can see right up there a number of critical groundwater areas. We have what we call seven critical groundwater areas in the state, and that's where the most significant constraints are in place by our agency. We have 12 groundwater limited areas, again, areas that we're concerned about and there are restrictions on, and two areas that are classified for reduced groundwater use, two areas that are withdrawn by order of the commission from additional groundwater use. So these are where those are located in the state. You can see some of those are right here in the Willamette Valley. And a key issue here, again, we think of the Willamette Valley as water rich, but our groundwater largely comes from
I didn't mean to cut them off literally, right? Is that map in our book or is that just up on the stage?
Yes. Go ahead. Mr. Chair, that map, I believe, is in your appendix, and I'm not certain as to...
It's under tab 12.
It's under tab 12.
I just can't see it.
Second to the last page. Second to the last page of your book. Maybe not second to last, third to last, looks like.
Thank you.
And please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the thing it's important to note here in this groundwater discussion is that largely our groundwater here in the Willamette Valley comes from a geologic structure that we call the Columbia River basalts. That's old water, water that's been deposited over time. And so those groundwater structures, as you can see in a number of parts of the state, are under some stress. And the Columbia River basalts being old water, have been deposited over time, don't recharge rapidly. as opposed to an aquifer down along a river, an alluvial aquifer. And so that's why we have this concern in Western Oregon about these aquifers.
Yes.
Now I have a real question.
Okay.
Trying to remember the earlier speech about not getting into policy and ways and means. So I'm trying to find a budget connection, but let me just try.
Representative Clem, given this committee's interest in water-related issues, I think it's going to be hard for me to do hard and fast lines. In fact, I'm hoping that the next item we get to that we'll spend a little bit of time on today, but I think that it's an item I'd like the committee to spend more time discussing, which is your broad study, which I think will give you the tools in the future to potentially have more informed policy arguments. But please proceed.
So Eola Hill, South Salem Hill. Yeah, I'm a representative from the Salem area. I've heard a lot of testimony over in my Measure 37 committee that your agency is not currently involved in whether or not the activities related to Measure 37 claims would, I mean, they're definitely groundwater limited area, or I think that's the term for those particular two. And my understanding, at least, I just would love to get the actual facts. Are you involved and able to be involved in the Measure 37 claim process to say whether or not it would create a health or safety or other issue because of water?
Chair, Representative, that is a substantive question.
Yes,
Representative.
It costs money, though, to be involved.
It absolutely, absolutely. And as you've correctly identified, we do have groundwater concerns in that part of the state. And so what we, but we do not, as an agency, make land use decisions. So what we can do is provide information to the local authorities that do make those decisions. And that's what we're attempting to do. The budget driver piece of this, Mr. Chair and Representative, is that it takes money to develop the science to provide truly informed information to local decision makers on these kind of issues.
So follow, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
So we know the science that we've done so far tells us it's definitely groundwater limited. So we've got that part done. And because you don't make the land use decision, the actual claims never come in front of your desk. Somebody else makes the land use decisions, and that's where the measure has those kind of waiver decisions made. And you are attempting in whatever ways you financially can to get the word out that, hey, before you make that decision, you may want to think about this. We hear wildly divergent testimony about whether water can be considered a health and safety issue or not, and also whether or not the people who are making those decisions even know whether there's a water issue because they're not experts. And this is a disturbing unknown when the ballot measure said health and safety, and yet we don't have any uniform way to know if water availability is considered a health or safety issue.
Representative Garrard.
Just a comment, perhaps for Representative Clem, in that to underline Mr. Ward's comments, that they supply information to local, let me underline the word local, jurisdictions. I think the general assumed responsibility of water in regards to Measure 37 is not part of Measure 37, but is a part of the local process and not the 37 process.
Mr. Chair and representatives, and so the place then, I'd agree with Representative Garrard, but the place then where it does come directly to us is when those folks, when and if folks with those claims come to us for a water right. And we might make a determination for whatever reason under our statutory authorities that there's not water available. So you could have a development platted, and if it's in an area where there are restrictions in place or the Water Resources Commission believes restrictions should be put in place, you could end up not being able to access, for example, groundwater to serve that development. That doesn't mean the development could not go forward if other sources of water were available. But there is a decision point that comes to us where our authorities are exercised, and it relates to the actual water right.
Last one.
Hearing on this on Monday, Mike.
Are you then going to get tagged for a Measure 37 claim if you deny someone a water right they could have had back in 1958? And then will your budget have to deal with hiring people to go through Measure 37 claims? Is there a second wave of claims for you?
That's a good way to link that to the budget.
I'm trying. Yeah, I got all kinds of little notes here.
Okay, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative, sadly, we've already had a number of claims lodged against the department for that very reason, where we have denied a water right or a water use, and where folks asserted they could have used that water at the time that they originally owned the property. The department has denied all those claims to this point, but there are a couple, two, I believe, beginning to work their way through the court process. So we will get to determine many of those questions you raised earlier. I need to add one clarification, if I may, Mr. Chair, real quickly. The place, and I think the instance where, for example, your constituents in South Salem would raise their hand and say, but, Mr. Ward, is the fact that for a domestic use, a person who wants to drill a well for domestic use, what we call an exempt use, does not have to come to us before they drill that well for a permit, unless we have specific restrictions in place that say they do. So generally around the state, if Lisa would like to drill a well next to me to satisfy her family needs and irrigate up to a half acre of lawn and garden, she can do that without us making a water availability analysis prior. So that's what kind of exacerbates this whole issue from folks' perspectives. Now, the commission has authority, Mr. Chair and Representative, to implement restrictions on exempt uses and has done so in several different parts of the state, pretty small areas largely. However, that requires, in our view, a very sound scientific basis to take that step, and that's where the budget issues, and we're going to delve into some of this directly in the days ahead. That's where the budget issues that you've identified come into play.
One quick question. Director Ward, could you clearly distinguish between when an area is groundwater limited and when it's a critical groundwater area?
Mr. Chair, I would do it better with a little help, with your permission.
Okay.
Barry, could you join us? Thank you, Lisa. This is Barry Norris, and we'll have him introduce himself for the record, but he's the state water resource engineer and is essentially the steward of those areas for our department.
Mr. Chair, I'm Barry Norris, and I'm administrator of our technical services division at the Water Resources Department. They're both a groundwater limited area and a groundwater critical area, both administrative processes to go into an area, define the boundaries, and manage the water. A groundwater limited area is a set of rules that define what future uses are going to be allowed and how to manage those. We could supposedly classify it for drip irrigation only and domestic use as an example. A critical area, we define the administrative boundaries, and we may allow new uses, we may not, but we also can go in and manage existing uses. We can define, for instance, a sustained annual yield in the aquifer because more water is being appropriated than is recharged each year, and then we can cut users back to that sustained annual yield, and that's our only administrative remedy where we can actually manage existing users.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we have indeed, in Senator Nelson's area, we actually have a situation where folks may have a rate and duty that they're legally entitled to, and they may only get to use 20% of what their water right permit or certificate would allow them to use if we weren't in that critical situation.
What I'm going to do at this point, Director Ward, is we'll try to finish budget drivers because I understand that the House is technically has been called in, but that they may not actually come to the floor for a while. And I'm just going to go through budget drivers, and I've had some of the House members ask if we could just keep going. But I'd actually prefer not to do that because my experience in Ways and Means
in previous sessions when we were continually told that we were not needed on the floor. And then about 5 minutes later, we were called back to the floor. And then it took us 20 minutes longer to get back in committee. And as we've been a little bit restless here this morning and a little bit less structured than the chair would like, I'd like to keep the discussion as focused as possible. So I'm just going to go through budget drivers, and then next Monday, when we're all refreshed and anxieties hopefully are a little bit less, we will start going through performance measures. So if you'll go on to the remaining items in the budget drivers, I did want to highlight this item that you're going to go to, I believe, next, because I would like to establish a good record on this item for the budget process, because I think it might be one of the items, let's say, under discussion in the budget process. So
thank you, Mr. Chair, and we will move forward then. So the question arose, what ought the Water Resources Department be doing about this issue of satisfying new demands in a system that's already pretty much spoken for? And we did a little survey. We had an intern from Oregon State who did a survey for us as to what other states were doing along these lines. And we found that of the 18 western states with similar water law as ours, 16 of those had a long-term strategy for addressing their water supply needs. Who did not? One was Alaska. Sadly, the other was Oregon. And so we began to talk internally and with our stakeholder groups about what we ought to be doing to lay the foundation to develop such a strategy. And we came up with this initiative that you will consider as part of the governor's budget for us in the days ahead. We've called it the Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. And it would do essentially five things. One, it would assess what Oregon's water needs are going to be over the next 30 years. Based on population inflow and all the other types of things that you take into consideration. Secondly, we felt like we needed to do an inventory around the state of potential storage sites. Now, we're not just talking about giant reservoirs and big dams. What we are talking about is where have sites been identified in the past around the state, and many have, for structures that could store water, both above ground and below ground in the aquifer, that we could still take advantage of today. And so we feel that's an important component of this piece, and frankly, we feel the underground portion of this equation has tremendous potential. And I just would note one quick example. The city of Pendleton recently built a new water treatment facility. They overbuilt it. They overbuilt their capacity. And as a result, we began an experiment with them, what we call a limited license, which is essentially a temporary project that allows them to go to the Umatilla water in the high flow, the Umatilla River in the high flow winter months, take that water at a time when it's available, run it through their treatment plant, clean it up to DEQ and Health Division water quality standards, and then run it back down, inject it down their municipal wells, which have been declining over time in water level. The result of that project has been that the city of Pendleton today, 60% of their domestic supply comes from winter Umatilla River water. Only 40% of their domestic supply now comes from native groundwater. So we believe as a part of this initiative, we need to find where the geology exists around the state to do this more broadly. The third piece, and an extremely important piece, is that we need to analyze how we can gain more supply here in Oregon through increased conservation. Oregon generally, on a per capita basis, is ahead of most of our neighbors in terms of conservation in water usage per person, but we think there are tremendous opportunities to gain new supply through conserving better and reusing water that has already been run through the system. So conservation and water reuse we see as an extremely important piece of this initiative, and this it would set aside some dollars to investigate that. The fourth piece there is the basin yield piece. In our view, we need to know how much water a basin's going to yield on an annual basis so we can tell whether water's available to take for storage. And the key piece of this is making sure we have water available that won't impact winter fish needs. So the ODF&W is doing some work for us even today on what we call a peak flow analysis. What are the peak flow needs of the fishery? So we can identify water that's beyond that that we can take to store for winter. And then the last piece is a direct result of our discussions with stakeholders. Would provide a modest amount of funding for us to partner with some local areas that want to do some water supply planning and need some help financially to do that. So that would provide a few funds to do that. So, Mr. Chair, that's the Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. I'm happy to respond to any questions if you have them.
I'll start a few of the questions. To what degree, you've already mentioned one other state agency, but I can think of at least four that have some role or some interest in water-related issues. And actually, if I go farther than that, soon it multiplies and starts to double and triple. To what degree is this going to be coordinated with other agencies and working with other agencies to see that some of their issues might be addressed?
Mr. Chair, as you've identified, water is definitely a shared resource, not only among the citizenry in Oregon, but among the government agencies. I think the positive piece of that is that there are clear, in my view, there are pretty clear lines delineated about who does what. So when you look at DEQ, you talk about water quality. When you come to us, we're the water quantity people. It's extremely important, even though there are pretty clear lines delineated, that we coordinate and work together. So as we built this process and discussed it with the governor's office, this was a part of the natural resource cabinet chaired by Mike Carrier's group's discussions, and we vetted it through that process together as we do all agency budget packages. And we would anticipate that we'd be partnering with a number of different agencies on much of this work. Fish and wildlife, absolutely. Geology and mineral industries will have some information that we can utilize here. DEQ, Health Division, all these folks, we believe, have to be in the loop as we step our way through this.
Bill, I was curious when you were talking about the Pendleton storage. What happens to the downstream people out of state? And I'm not familiar enough with the Umatilla River to know where it flows when it leaves Oregon. But I know we have jurisdiction during the state of in the state of Oregon. But as in the Klamath Basin, where a lot of the problems come from, is when that water crosses the state line.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't, of course, have jurisdiction beyond our state line. And so as you've noted, it was interesting to me that a number of the big, very large wells that were sunk on the California side during the Klamath crisis were sunk right south of that border and actually draw water and have impacted Oregonians as a result of that. But we do not have authority unless there's specific compact language in place that would allow it to impact what another state does. We have to do it by diplomacy. And in the Columbia, for example, there have been numerous attempts in the last 30 years to establish a Columbia compact among the states that are impacted by an impact, the Columbia. None of those, there's been tremendous amount of money spent, and a lot of lawyers I'm sure we've helped keep employed hasn't borne fruit to this point. Okay.
Representative Dingfelter wants to enter the fray, she said.
And I just want to let the committee know that we are doing an informational hearing on groundwater in my policy committee on Monday, so if anyone is interested, you're welcome to join and sit up at the dais, so just let me know. Question I have about number... I guess it's the conservation, analyzed conservation opportunities, and we've talked about this, and, you know, I'm a big proponent of water conservation and reuse, but the question I have for the agency is, what plans do you have to also look at economic tools? In other words, one thing I haven't really seen the agency do, unlike some other agencies, is really look at economic tools for promoting or incentivizing conservation and reuse. For instance, I'll give a few examples. Tax credits or tax incentives, number one. Two is looking at rate structures. We all know that municipalities, and I'm sure Willie will probably cringe back there, but most municipalities in the state do have rate structures that incent customers to, use less, as it used to be flat rates, as we know. You could use 10 gallons, you can use 1,000 gallons, and still pay the same rate per gallon. But I think that's changed. However, I'm wondering if the agency's ever done a study to look at municipalities across the state, you know, what we can do, not just by, you know, getting more FTE on the ground, but having policies that can help save and conserve water. And I haven't seen that at any great length that I know of, so maybe you just need to educate me about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will have to be informed if we at some time in the past have done a comprehensive analysis of economic incentives along the line that you've described. However, I think a project of the nature that we're looking at in this budget proposal would have to identify means to the end. And that would include... the type of things that you're describing, in my view. So I would trust that as we work through this, identify where the opportunities for conservation are, then we need to also have an eye and identify in writing what some of the strategies would be, economic and otherwise, for attaining those, those gains.
Just a follow-up question. The chair asked about you partnering with other agencies as far as with other entities. I mean, I'm thinking about the League of Oregon Cities, the irrigation districts, Farm Bureau. Are you going to have any type of opportunity for stakeholder involvement in this process?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that we will have to ultimately, if we are to gain the outcome that I hope we gain. And a lot of this work is providing the science basis for the development of the long-term strategy. So a lot of this work, we just need to get out and get the science done. But then to take that next step and begin to put a strategy together, if we don't involve our stakeholders, as you all would probably tell me with some authority, our chances of success are limited. So we would agree this needs to have a stakeholder process involved with it.
Mr. Chair? Yes.
We've got this it's called the big look going on relative to land use, and I'm kind of viewing the Supply and Conservation Initiative as the big look relative to water use. And but we've also got several efforts going on now that would, create storage, places of storage or different methods of irrigation and things like this. I don't know how to evaluate the initiative relative to those other efforts that are before the legislature now and vice versa. Can you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, I'll sure attempt to. I think over time... for us to do a credible and thoughtful job at meeting Oregon's water supply needs, we need to have something like this in place, which lays out the strategy and begins and identifies where the best opportunities are. That's not to preclude there may be an opportunity that pops up that this legislature might choose to go forward with today because it looks good and would meet a real need. But I think in our view, over time, this kind of work needs to be done to provide the roadmap for where we go to get that supply. Again, not to preclude something that you all might feel is appropriate today to move forward with because of the merits. But I think over time we'd be wise to have a real clear roadmap as to where we're going and how.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, just going back to the LIDAR situation, would any of this analysis tie in with the LIDAR system that's being considered?
If you might comment, Mr. Ward, we've had a discussion of the LIDAR system, the DAGAMI project. Ultimately, in the budget, we will probably provide some resources for that, what the relationship might be to this.
Mr. Chair and Senator, and as we've talked about the LIDAR program, again, we had a presentation in with the Natural Resource Agencies some months ago. It appears to me that some of the information and the data layers generated by that could be useful in a process of this nature.
Couple more questions. If we were talking about transportation planning, we could probably be talking in 20-year horizons, long-term land use planning, 40-year horizons. What sort of horizon is planned for the study?
Mr. Chair, we have talked internally about 20 to 30-year horizon. I think our thinking at this point is that a responsible look needs to be a 30-year horizon here, largely because to implement some of the things that we hope to see come out of this are not going to happen overnight.
Okay. Follow-up question. Although I know the science related to this, that there are ongoing debates about what the projections are, would you be taking into consideration, this is not a 2 or 3 year issue, but this could be a 30-year issue, what the impacts of climate change might be on water supply in the state? Meaning that I think most of those have indicated that you might have even more ample supply during the times when you have ample supply now, and even less supply during the times that you have problems with supply, probably pushing you more towards a direction of having to of having to find ways to not only conserve but ways to store water.
Mr. Chair, I would think that's an excellent point. And certainly our water delivery timing and all those kind of things may change here in Oregon in the years ahead. I agree that we need to factor this information into an effort of this nature. Our staff has a relatively a close working relationship with the folks up at the University of Washington that have done some leading work along these lines, and we would certainly want to interface with those folks as we develop our projections.
Additional questions? Okay, we'll go on to the final item for this.
Just one final slide here quickly. This, the blue here just shows you where stream flow would be available for storage purposes in the winter months.
Representative Burley.
Bill, would you help me in the Deschutes Basin? Where's that blue star? I couldn't quite figure that out.
That little blue piece?
At the north end of the Deschutes Basin. Is that below Pelton Round Butte?
Yeah.
I think that's further down river.
Yeah, it's below Pelton Round Butte.
Okay.
Yeah. And so you see in the areas that don't have water available here in the winter, it's either because there are storage obligations on that water already. There are significant in-stream winter water rights in place. or, and this is what catches the Deschutes Basin a lot, the scenic waterway requirements that we're required to acknowledge and function under.
Great opportunity here to institute a model that Colorado pioneered, and we could pipe or siphon some of that water over the Cascades to fill in the Deschutes.
Chair Representative, I have no comment on that.
I actually thought Representative Burley was going to refer to the city of Los Angeles or the county of Los Angeles and its water supply.
We need a long water hose.
Our final... I'm sorry, Senator
Nelson. I just noticed on that slide you had a 50% exceedance, and on the August slide there was 80% exceedance. Why is there a difference between those two? And the exceedance thing, I'm always confused about, what does exceedance mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator, excellent point. Excellent question. So in the summer months, we generally, to analyze... If water's available at 80% exceedance, essentially it's available 80% of the time, 8 years out of 10 in that location. And so when we estimate available stream flow in the summer, because constraints are so much more severe in the summer, we want to give people a realistic look at how often they'd be able to have that water available to them if, for example, they get a water right. In the winter, and for storage purposes, you don't need water every day. And if there are short windows when it's available, then you might want to be able to take it. So we have a less stringent look at water availability for winter than we do in the dry season months.
Does that include even the Columbia, or do they have a different standard for the Columbia versus the rest of the state?
Mr. Chair, Senator, and staff can correct me if I misspeak here, but I don't believe we've done a classic water availability analysis for the Columbia, and there's a lot of reasons for that. One, the fish flow targets that are in place. One, the shared border that we talked about earlier. And so our classic model for water availability doesn't work in the Columbia.
Did you have anything additional? Okay, the final slide then.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I actually am going to sneak another slide or two in on you here, but budget drivers and issues, again, were to workload and resources. And I think I can say with a lot of confidence that we have experienced both significant declines in staff, real declines, absolute declines in staff numbers in the last decade, while we've had a significant increase in workload. Go ahead. So this is my graphic to indicate what I just said in terms of the staff thing. We are, as a state agency, peaked in our state FTE at 161 back in the mid-90s. Since that time, you see where we are in 05, 07. We're down to 138, about 12% fewer staff. And this has been exacerbated by the losses we've seen of county staff that have partnered with us historically. So at one time, there were about 40 assistant watermasters around the state employed by counties. Today, there are about 15, Tom, about 15. And so our staff losses can be directly added to the loss of those county positions because they worked directly under our supervision and helped us manage the resource out there. So decreasing resources, we're not blowing smoke at you here. It's very, very real for this agency.
So... is like in Douglas County when I went and visited with the water master, is that then one of your people who is housed sits in the county but is actually the state water master works for you then?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we do have a state water master in Douglas County, but do we have county staff out of Douglas County anymore or not?
We have one.
We do have one assistant water master then that's a part of that office in Douglas County.
So So in various counties, there might be a state water master who works for you and then an assistant who works for the county, and they work together.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's exactly correct. And quite often, our state-funded water masters are funded, for example, in a county office because of that historic partnership. It's actually worked really well over time. The challenge has been as counties have faced resources constraints just like states, they've reduced their commitment there. Just a quick note, about a 31% increase in water rights that we administer every year since 1995. We actually see about 4,000 new wells go in Oregon every year. Most of those are exempt wells, Representative, like we talked about earlier, but we do see about 4,000 new wells go in every year, get about 460 new water right applications filed every year. So our response has been, and frankly, you know, this, the initiation of much of this predates me, so I can brag about it a little bit, but our response has been to go after our processes with technology. And you've seen our you've seen the department actually be able to deal with the workload as a result of some advances in our technological processes that have been really significant. One of the things that one of my predecessors did was he assigned our computer folks to an operational division, to our technical services division, rather than assigning them to the administrative portion of the agency. As a result, we have a tremendous marriage between the program people and the people who do the IS support for those people. It's resulted in the development of tools that have caused us to be able to make some real gains from a technology standpoint. So, Mr. Chair, this is how we've addressed it. Also, we've done a lot in recent years relative to streamlining our processes. I've laughed that we've rewarded good performance in certain of our staff members by assigning them really tough and nasty jobs to streamline our processes. This individual sitting next to me, Debbie here, she now supervises our transfer section where we've had a really significant backlog, and as you'll hear later on, are making good gains as a result of some of the streamlining. And then the last thing I note, you all gave us authority a session or two ago. Was it two sessions ago initially, and then you continued it last session? We'll be asking for you to continue the position authority related to that in this budget. Is that we have a program now that allows folks, if they want to go to the head of the processing line, they can pay the full freight to do that, and we have a little cadre of contractors for a number of our processes that then we'll assign their base processing work out to. And it's allowed folks with a critical need to move water around or to get a new right settled, yay or nay, in a quick manner, to move through the process with the investment of their own money to do so. So I think that, Mr. Chair, that gets us through our budget drivers and issues. I'd be happy to respond to any more questions.
I'll back up just for 1 second to the study again. I just wanted to get another item on the record. In terms of working with stakeholders on the water-related issues, I would assume that would include some of the tribal government.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent point. And the tribes have tremendous claims and water use needs here in Oregon. And we actually have a very close working relationship. I think if you were to have the Umatilla tribe, for example, in here before you today, they'd say that despite some divergent views, sometimes between the state and the tribe, on who owns what water, et cetera, that we've been working together very closely to meet both the tribes and the state's water interests. So, yes, I'm sorry I didn't mention that earlier. Key piece of the equation.
Anything additional at this point that anyone wants to bring up? Yes, Senator Nelson.
From correspondence I received from Fish and Wildlife and from your department, I have the sense that there is a tremendous amount of water available from the Columbia River in the winter months. And the comparison that I've heard and I'm developing is that it's there's enough water in the Columbia River that would equal the amount of the flow of the Colorado River on a year-round basis. Is there any way you could find out that information? What I've heard is there's 15,000 cubic feet per second available, and you're supposed to double that by two from your little card here. That's 30,000 acre feet a day times 30 days. It's a million acre feet a month. And I don't know if that's right or not, but that's I'd sure like some information. It's probably, I can't tie it to the budget. I don't know. I have to talk to Representative Clamp about that. How can I do
that? I'll get there.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, quickly, there is a heck of a lot of water in the Columbia in the winter, and we've actually done an analysis as to how much of that would be available for use in storage. We did that analysis in cooperation with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, so we have a signed-off position between the two agencies, and we'd be happy to provide that analysis to you and anyone else on the committee that would like it.
Yes. While we're on a similar topic, my understanding is, thank you, Mr. Chair, that there's 30,000 or 80,000 acre-feet of unappropriated water in Lake Billy Chinook, and there's some issues or questions surrounding that, and you don't need to answer now, but maybe if you wouldn't mind just giving me a quick briefing paper on that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I can't answer that right now, Representative, but we'll be happy to research that and get that back to you.
And with that, we are, Mr. Ward and everyone here in the audience, we are adjourned till Monday, and we will resume with the Water Resources Department on Monday.
Thank you.